Welcome to the bike show. I'm Jack Thurston and I'm standing on Blackfriars Bridge, which is a very symbolically important part of London if you're a cyclist. This is the site of the kind of rebirth of high profile cycle campaigning in London with the Blackfriars Flash Ride, so the great battle over Blackfriars Bridge a few years ago, a series of very big protest rides ultimately have led to the creation of a cycle path, which is in front of me. Very wide two-way cycle path, taking out a lane of motor traffic and giving people on bikes a dedicated, safe, protected way of getting across the bridge. And they're enjoying it. Up to 70% of traffic at peak times on the bridge is bicycles. It's very much proof of the idea that if you build it, they will come. But not everybody is happy about what's going on in London with the cycle superhighways that are being built. And we are in the midst of something that is being referred to as bike lash. This is people saying, enough of these bike lanes, they're causing congestion, they're causing pollution. Who are these over-entitled cyclists anyway? And why are they getting their own spaces to ride? Here with me to talk about bike lash, what is bike lash, the rights and wrongs, and what should we as people who ride bikes think and do about bike lash, is Claire Rogers, who is the coordinator of the Enfield Cycling Campaign and recent winner of the London Cycling Campaign's Campaigner of the Year. Claire, welcome to the bike show.
Thanks, Jack.
That puts you in really great company because there are some terrific cycle campaigners around London, people like David Arditti up in Brent, who's played such an important role in changing the way cycle campaigners thinking about what we should be doing, the late great Barry Mason. So you're really up there with a constellation of stars. Also joining me is Robert Wright, who is a reporter for the Financial Times and the current transport correspondent of that newspaper. He also writes about cycling on his blog. Welcome to the bike show, Robert.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
So you're back in London after 4 years in New York City, where you were working for the Financial Times over in New York City. You must have seen the differences.
Well, there's a fantastic difference coming back. I was riding every day in New York. A lot of people in London will tell you, oh, they're doing fantastic things in New York. In New York, there's 1% mode share of commuting is for cycling. Here, it's much higher, still could be higher. But these cycle superhighways we see are such fantastic change, so much more relaxing to use. My office is quite near here. I used to ride over Blackfriars Bridge pretty regularly. It was a pretty unpleasant experience very frequently, pretty hairy. Now it's a relaxing, straightforward, good experience. So that is an enormous change, yes.
And Claire, it must be wonderful as a cycle campaigner in London to look at this stretch of tarmac that's been put in here for cyclists, particularly on Blackfriars Bridge, where we've done so much campaigning. Were you on any of the flash rides? Have you been involved in that?
I'm actually very new to cycle campaigning. I'm even very new to cycling. I've only been cycling regularly to take my daughter to school for a year. So I've sort of come into this just wowed by the work that's been done by London Cycling Campaign and Stop Killing Cyclists and all of those people. And after the LCC AGM, I rode back across Blackfriars Bridge, and it was just an amazing experience to see what cycle campaigners have achieved.
Okay, well, it's quite noisy here. We're looking at buses and vans and everything going past. The peak rush hour of cyclists has gone, and now we're seeing these images of an empty cycle lane and a lot of cars in and buses and vans all backed up at the traffic lights. These are the kind of images that have been on the front page of newspapers like the Daily Mail, not the Financial Times, I hasten to add. But let's talk about bike lash. But should we go down off the bridge here so it's a little bit quieter and we're not breathing in quite so much pollution? So should we try and describe what bike lash is? I mentioned front pages of the Daily Mail showing empty cycle lanes and tailbacks of motor traffic. What other elements of bike lash are there? And maybe, Robert, you should try and elaborate on this, because you were over in New York where I guess the term was coined in relation to a bike lane project in New York City.
I don't think the Daily Mail actually cares about transport policy or cycling policy. A very small number of people actually care about these things. I think this fits into a worldview for papers like that, that you've got bumbling civil servants who are trying to impose their politically correct way of doing things on other people, and that is why the picture of a scheme that, you know, on the face of it, when you see the picture, doesn't seem to be working, it fits into that kind of worldview rather than anything specifically to do with cycling. People get really irritated about it when they think that something dear to them is threatened. In New York, that was often free on-street car parking is a huge thing there, because you have a relatively dense city with relatively few parking spaces. That was often a huge issue there. And here, the congestion is something that is upsetting people. You know, at the very least, we have to face up to the fact that all motor traffic in the second quarter this year, according to Transport for London, was down 4.1%, and motor vehicle speeds fell 12%, which shows that, for one reason or another, the capacity of the road network fell pretty sharply at that point. So, you know, it's understandable. Not saying they're right, but it's understandable at least that people are going to say, what changed? Cycle superhighways went in. So there's a whole bunch of different things going on here. So I think it's a complex phenomenon.
And how about up where you are? Because there have been some schemes, mini Hollands, these schemes to kind of civilise places where people go and shop and eat and shopping streets, essentially, isn't it?
Yep.
And to make them less dominated by motor cars.
Enfield's Mini Holland could be a really extraordinary transformation. We're really excited about it. But it has seen a huge amount of bikelash, I should say. And that predominantly at first came from the local business owners, who were very upset that a small number of parking spaces were going to be moved from the high street to off-street parking. Most of the parking actually is staying in place, and the cycle lanes will go between the parking and the pavement. But that's been the source of the business community's objections, that shoppers will no longer come to their shops. Effectively, the high street will die, is what they're saying. And it's very frustrating for us, who are in favour of the cycle lanes and also the quietened streets that are going to follow, because all the evidence shows that, you know, New York is a great example, that when cycle lanes go in, business income goes up, because you're creating more pleasant, people-friendly high streets, and that's where people want to be, and they'll spend time and they'll spend money. So we've seen the business community objecting, and also just the same objections as in central London, that these bike lanes will cause congestion and cause pollution. Well, I think behind it is, as Robert has already said, that there's a sort of fear of something has been taken away from me. My parking space is going to go, my journey time is going to increase, all for the sake of this tiny minority of lycra crowd cyclists who no one can really identify with. And there's a failure to recognise that it's for everyone. It's for children cycling to school, it's for parents, it's for shopping. It's just seen as, you know, this alien group is taking something away from me.
And there's another strand which I've observed in London, and I suppose also in New York. And in London, it's kind of expressed, I think, most clearly by the Guardian journalist Dave Hill, who basically sees cyclists as harbingers of gentrification. And he sees that where you put in a cycle lane, you are going to gentrify a traditional working class part of London. And he thinks that is a bad thing, and he thinks that this should be resisted. And that's a very sort of strange and convoluted argument, isn't it?
This is a real risk that people need to think about hard, because the risk in London at the moment is you've had a right-wing city government under Boris Johnson that's put in these cycle lanes. Boris Johnson very unusually cared about these things because he was a cyclist himself. And you have a Labour administration coming in whose constituencies are not by and large riding bikes. You need to put some capital into a bicycle. Poorer people in London are by and large getting about by bus, and bus reliability is going down. So people do need to think about this. This is not, it seems to me, a trivial point. And that was a similar thing to what happened in New York when the an awful lot of the progress, which again I think was actually fairly limited and is often exaggerated, but an awful lot of the progress was made under the Bloomberg administration. You then had the de Blasio administration coming in. Their constituency was very different. It was a democratic, relatively left-wing, relatively minority-heavy constituency, and these people could not see what bicycle lanes were doing for them. And in fact, they tended to see them as a negative thing. So one needs to think about this and think about how one can make, for instance, cycling a more multicultural activity, make sure that it's something that, you know, is helping people who are living in poorer bits of London to become more mobile. There is a class element here, and, you know, people need to start thinking about
it. It's quite interesting that on the one hand, cycling has always been regarded as the poor man's transport in Britain, but now it's suddenly seen as something that you've got to have a £10,000 bike and be clad in expensive Rafa clothing. So in a way, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. It feels like there are people who just don't like people on bikes and will use any stick to beat them with. So people will say, oh, you're too poor to have a car, or get out of my way, I'm in my car, I pay my road tax, that kind of argument. And then you've got people like Dave Hill saying, oh, you're all a bunch of upwardly mobile, floppy-haired graphic designers on your fixed-gear bicycles or your expensive racing bikes. And it feels like we're sort of under attack from both directions.
I think that argument was very much made in Waltham Forest, but I think the Waltham Forest Mini Holland has just been shown to be phenomenally successful. It's not even finished yet. And I think where you provide great infrastructure, so in Waltham Forest you've got streets that are, have modal filters so bikes can get through and cars can't, and so they've cut rat running, they've cut through drivers, and they've got this lovely quiet network of streets, plus they've got cycle lanes on main roads. And where you provide that, you see all sorts of different groups cycling, and I think that just shuts the argument up. When I last went to Waltham Forest, I saw Rastafarians, Hasidic Jews, and people who look Muslim on bicycles, and it just has become such a normal part of everyday life that I think that just puts paid to the argument. You just got to put the infrastructure in, and then all sorts of groups get involved.
I would just say that I agree that once you get the infrastructure in, things do start changing. When I first moved back to London in July from New York, I was in temporary accommodation in Limehouse, and I was going down the segregated lane on Cable Street, which is not particularly new, but it links up to the East-West Cycle Superhighway. And it was noticeable that one was seeing families that appeared to be immigrant families, relatively new arrivals in this country. You're seeing even women cycling in chalwar kameez a little bit. One of the challenges with cycling at the moment in London, because you don't have a joined-up safe network, is that you need a certain skill. You need to know what you're doing on the road. And so, you know, people who've had that skill handed down in their family, and I was taught stuff about bikes by my dad, have an advantage and are more prone to doing it. Once it becomes easier, I think you probably do get different social groups doing it.
Do you think that the bike clash that we're seeing is in any way proportionate to actually what's happening on the ground? Because it strikes me that it's disproportionate, and I'm interested in why this issue gets picked up as an issue that people want to run with, where you get regular op-ed columns in the newspapers. They're fairly join the dots, there's a sort of formula to them, and you get Jeremy Clarkson, Janet Street Porter wrote one, a lot of these kind of quite high profile names, celebrity opinion formers having their rants about people on bikes. I'm just curious about all the things that there are in the country that there are to complain about, yet this one gets elevated and people have such a kind of itch that they need to scratch on this issue, and I don't understand why it has that enormous salience.
People are driven an awful lot by disgust, actually, and I think sometimes people feel, you know, the sort of physicality of cycling seems to bother people on some level. I'm often struck by that. People get upset at the idea that you're sweaty going places and things. There are a number of sort of strange, visceral things going on there, but I don't think this is necessarily about cycling. I think this is about people's irritation with the way that things are done and a feeling that there isn't common sense, is not in charge and things. And you see, I know an awful lot of people say there is some big plot out there. All I can say is I was transport correspondent at the FT for 8 years. I'm back doing it temporarily at the moment. I have not seen evidence of this plot. Now, obviously, I would be quite a bad person for them to approach and, you know, If they hear this, they'll be even less likely to come and see me. But an awful lot of things in public life, you get waves of articles about things. People copy each other. I'm not sure that you need to construct a
conspiracy. But you work in newspapers. Why do they say, yes, I'll have that op-ed against cycling, even though it's been run dozens of times before and there's nothing new about it? Why do the commissioning people send someone out to do these stories when it's clearly a little bit of a fact-free zone? What's the reason? Why does this stuff get commissioned, this rubbish? I mean, because I'm going to call it rubbish, because I think it is rubbish a lot of the time. And I'm sure there are nuanced arguments one can have, but those are not the things that I'm talking about.
What people want to do when they work for a newspaper is they want to give what they think people will see as being a relatable, view of the world. And there are a lot of people who are irritated about these things. And if you go to a dinner party in London, you know, there's a good chance somebody will complain about cycle lanes. So it's, you know, some of these people who are at dinner parties have control of editorial policy of policies of newspapers. You know, there's, I don't think it's more than that. You know, there is a general irritation. And as I say, in London at the moment, there is worsening congestion. People are irritated about it, and people have got a relatively easy target to point to for having caused it.
Do you subscribe to that view, Claire, that it's just a general irritation, or is there something darker about this and more organised?
I don't think there's anything dark or organised. I think it does reflect public opinion, what people are talking about at parties and social occasions. And I think it's clickbait, isn't it? Apparently anything about cycling just gets that many more clicks on online magazines and so on. We thought in our local environment, Enfield, we thought the local papers were really somehow anti-cycling, anything to do with cycling. And we realised actually they were just attracted to the controversy. People wanted to read about the controversy, about all the people who were objecting to Cycle Enfield, as the Mini Holland is called. And so we realised that they weren't really printing what we were doing, because all we were doing was making statements about why we think it's a good thing. Whereas the antis were doing exciting things like taking the council to court with judicial reviews and so on. So we realised we needed to do something creative and interesting to get the attention of the local press. And what we did was to organise a thank you breakfast for the guys who are building the bike lanes. We took them bacon rolls on our bikes and tea and coffee and set up a table and released a press release to the local press. And they were all over it. They loved it. We got a really positive article, nice photos. We just realised they just want to print stories that people will read.
That is a brilliant idea. Who thought, was that your idea? You dreamt that one up?
It came to me in the shower, so I think it was divinely inspired.
Brilliant. That is such a great idea. Organise a breakfast where you feed the workmen in their hi-vis and with their pneumatic drills who are building the stuff that you want. What a great idea.
Can I say I could almost weep at hearing this creativity, because this is something that cycle campaigners, I think, need to think about. People have said to me on Twitter last year, oh, we made good arguments, our arguments are good, they don't work. Well, the point is, just making an argument is not necessarily enough. You know, you need to make it in some kind of creative, attractive way to get people's attention. That's what the job is about. One other point that I think is perhaps a bit different about the Enfield experience and where we're standing here that has really struck me since I came back to London. Outer London, I think, is more like other bits of the UK. In that I think about 90% of trips in outer London are by motor vehicle. So there's, you know, in some ways there's quite a lot of low-hanging fruit in outer London. Yes. In a way that there isn't here. So we need, you know, we need to think carefully about how different the issues are here. Here, you're getting people onto bikes, typically who'll have been commuting by underground or by heavy rail or something like that. So you're actually bringing extra people onto the streets, which, you know, again, I think it's a good thing, but it's a challenge. In somewhere like Enfield, you've got so many space-hungry motor vehicles running about. There are quite a lot of private car journeys that you can still convert, which is a big difference.
They've worked out that 80% of car journeys in Enfield could be bikeable.
I'm not surprised you're seeing these fantastic results from the Waltham Forest Mini Holland, because there is, you know, there is this low-hanging fruit there, and the issues are just different and need to think about them in different ways, I think.
And also, these Mini Hollands are just as much about making a pleasant street scene for people on foot as they are about people on bikes, whereas this cycle highway here that we can see going across the Thames and along the embankment, that is something for people on bikes and, I suppose, joggers, because joggers do like going on the embankment in the cycle superhighway. But ultimately, if you're making it for people on foot, everybody is on foot at some point of their day, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. To add to the embankment points, Val Shawcross said at the London Cycling Campaign meeting that people are writing to her saying it's much more pleasant to walk alongside the embankment, because they have the cycle lane as a buffer between them and the motor traffic. So I think a lot of this is just about reducing the volume of motor traffic, whether it's here or whether it's in Enfield's Mini Holland, out of London. It's motor traffic that is so damaging to the street scene and to people's health, including mental health. That's what we need to reduce. And that's where Waltham Forest has been so inspirational, because they've, I don't know if you've read the statistics, but they've recently released research showing that they've reduced by 16% motor car journeys. So I think 10,000 fewer vehicles per day passing through Waltham Forest, which is great. That's what we need.
So Bike Lash is something that we see on the newspaper front pages. We hear it on the talk radio. You hear about it in policy discussions, lobby groups kind of coming at each other. But do you think it could possibly be affecting us on the roads? The fact that people can drive their cars in a way that's hostile to you. They can drive their cars at you. They can do these punishment passes. People can be very inconsiderate. Robert, you blogged recently about how you got a puncture from a tack that was on the ground, and you raised the suspicion that these tacks might have been put down deliberately. Is this a kind of guerrilla war level of bike clash? And is there a risk that newspapers, by fueling it, politicians, by fueling it, are actually endangering people on the roads? And is that something that we should be worried about, and that they should be worried about, and that they should be a bit more responsible about? Robert, tell us about the tacks.
Well, I'm not. I still don't know why that tack happened to be there in that particular cycle path, and you know, maybe it was there. Maybe it was there by chance. So I can't really talk about exactly why that was there. But I think we have to be clear that the kind of rhetoric one hears, kind of angry anti-cycling rhetoric, does have an effect. I'm pretty clear about that myself. I notice quite a lot of bad driving around me. Even sometimes when I'm out with my kids, people drive fast around us. These narrow London side streets where a lot of the quiet ways go, people will drive at you pretty fast. So people's irritation does spill over into how they drive. It can be scary. But of course, the great thing about this bike lash is that it's coming at a time when we have got the cycle superhighways. So actually, you know, I'm finding I'm spending an awful lot less time interacting with motorists because I'm riding on them. And in the mornings, I'm coming down the main road and I'm in a big peloton of cyclists. And sometimes we get close passes, but you know, I'm like the antelope in the middle of the herd quite a lot of the time. You know, the lions are closer to somebody else other than me. So yeah, there is irritation out there. Fortunately, some of the things people are irritated about are helping to protect us from it, I think.
Claire, I mean, you're a new cyclist, so you probably haven't got the great long view to determine whether things are getting worse or better in terms of the way that people are driving. But does that sort of thing worry you, that it legitimises a view that cyclists are somehow fair game or undeserving of people's attention and care on the roads?
Possibly. I mean, just to say, in Enfield, I'm so jealous listening to Robert in his peloton of cyclists. That just doesn't happen in Enfield. You're so lucky if you see a single cyclist, and it's always a man, and it's always a white man of a certain age. So I would love to see that in Enfield. And anecdotally, I've got friends and fellow cycle campaigners who cycle into town from Enfield for work. And they tell me that the behaviour of drivers is far worse outside the North Circular than it is inside. And I think it's to do with that lack of safety and numbers. And also anecdotally, I know that drivers have behaved threateningly in Enfield. And I don't know whether that's to do with the local press, so that they outcry against the Mini Holland, or it's just that drivers aren't used to seeing people on bikes. But I do know of one cyclist who's part of our Better Streets for Enfield group. And he was stopped at a red light on his bike, and the driver behind him began honking his horn, shouting, "Get out of my way." And this man turned around and he said, "No, I won't get out of the way." And when the light went green, he was rammed by the driver behind him, completely deliberately. So he used his car as an assault weapon. There's no other way of putting it, buckling the back wheel of the bicycle. So there is that sort of element around. I don't know whether it's fueled by the debate or if it's just how people are.
Some people say that bike clash is a sign of the failure of campaigners to make their arguments convincingly, that this is still being fought over means that we haven't kind of won the arguments. And another way of looking at it is that sort of vociferous bike clash is a sign of the success of cycle campaigners, because we're actually making a difference and we are creating things that are changing the city streets. We're not just campaigning for a few extra cycle parking stands or encouraging employers to put in showers at work or a few more cycle training places. Though those things are all perfectly nice, and they used to be the bread and butter of London cycle campaigning within 10 years ago, I think, before the focus was on infrastructure. Finally, we are making some changes and they are getting a reaction. You know, every action gets a reaction. Where do you stand on whether it's a sign of success or failure?
The thing that one sees here that worries me is that I don't think it has become a consistent part of London transport policy to put in space for cycling. For years, people wanted the sort of green halo of being in favour of cycling, but they didn't actually want to cause a hassle, which is why you see so many poor cycling facilities that don't really take away space. The Central London Congestion Charter is no longer really argued about. We need to make this policy like that, and it needs to be something that people don't argue about anymore. Is that failure? Is that a sign of success? I'm not sure. It's a sign that the work isn't complete yet.
You're worried that it might be undone and unpicked, so it's still very much a live argument. It's not the kind of death rattle of the anti-campaign. Well, we're still very much in the balance.
Well, what I'm worried about, and again, this is, you know, experience in New York when you had the change from the Bloomberg to the de Blasio administration, is that progress just stopped. Now that, you know, nothing happened for ages. And that's what I'm worried about now, because you've got a system of cycle superhighways that isn't really joined up. That really needs more work to create far more seamless journeys, and progress has stopped. So, you know, you're in a slightly unsatisfactory halfway stage where, you know, these are good, but they could be so much better. And, you know, I think we need to press on. I'll tell you one thing that I think people should be saying to Sadiq Khan, and this is something that you often see politicians pick up later in their term. The great thing about cycle infrastructure is you can do it quickly. You can't build something like Crossrail fast. Sadiq Khan is not going to get Crossrail 2 built during his term, and he's not going to have the money to do it. And I would suggest that in a year or two, he's maybe going to wake up to the fact that this is something he can actually do. So I hope people are making that case to him already, that, you know, this is, you know, whatever your misgivings about it, this can be part of your legacy.
So, Claire, do you think it's a sign of success or a sign of failure that people like the Daily Mail and the London Taxi Drivers Association and the executives of the Canary Wharf Group are battling us in the courts, in the newspapers, massing their taxis outside Transport for London?
It does feel a little bit in the balance, although I have to say all the, you know, when I've heard about court cases such as the one in New York and also in Enfield on the local scale, those cases have both failed, and the local authority has carried on and put in the cycle lanes that they intended to. So it feels like we're heading in the right direction. I think it is a sign that people are recognising this is real change, and that's good. You want change, but you want it to be followed by, I think, the four stages of social change are ridicule is number one. The second one is violent protest. Certainly seen that in Waltham Forest with people carrying coffins down the high street. And then the third one is acceptance. And I think in Waltham Forest, they're kind of seeing something along those lines. And then the fourth stage is apparently, actually, I believed in this all along, and we're not at that stage yet.
The famous Prospect Park West bike lane lawsuit, which went on for years and years and years and years, and has only just finished. The point about that was that that lawsuit ultimately failed, but what it certainly did do is it made the Department of Transportation in New York extremely nervous about putting in other facilities of that quality. There's another side, Prospect Park Southwest, that could really do with a similar facility. Absolutely no discussion about putting something in there because they don't want the same grief. So these lawsuits can have a real chilling effect on things, and people need to be very worried about that, I think.
Well, Bikelash, as we've discussed, is not something that's confined to London. It's been going on all around the world, I think. Wherever things are being done to help cyclists, you get a reaction against it. And the excellent Streets blog over in the United States and their offshoot Streets Films put together a short film, about 5 minutes, with a bunch of cycle campaigners and advocates and policymakers from across the United States talking about Bikelash. So let's have a listen to that.
Bikelash, I think, a little counterintuitively, is a great thing to be dealing with. It's a high-class problem to have, because it means we're actually making a difference. It means we're actually forcing difficult decisions in a good way, in a constructive way, on communities as they decide what they're going to look like in the future.
Bikelash, for us, for everyone, is when the media talks about biking issues in a default negative way. For example, they say things like, bicyclist not wearing helmet gets hit by car, and they're insinuating that a bicyclist's reckless behavior might have caused this issue.
There certainly is Bikelash in Chicago. I think for the most part it's gone underground, because the official narrative in the city is that we're trying to make cycling better and that cycling is important, and they're seeing so many people out riding, and so dealing with that underground backlash is a little bit tricky. It's really about storytelling and putting a human face on it.
The number one thing I've done to really reframe or change people's minds on how they talk about bike lash is asking people to remember their childhood. So they remember either the first time they fell off their bike or the first time they rode far away from their parents. It was the first sense of independence. And everyone has typically a very positive association with their first ride. So once you get people in that space where they're thinking about what it was like to ride as a kid, you've got them primed and ready and willing to listen to your message.
Well, we've been stuck in bike lash in Portland for the last 20 years. I mean, between our daily newspaper and the business associations and just absolute misperception of the issues, you know, we've been forever dealing with this argument of special interest group, completely misunderstanding how this is good for the economy, how this is good for the city, how it's good for the very businesses who are fighting against it.
Especially when they talk about incidents as accidents rather than collisions, which is what they are. So by doing things like that, by reporting on issues automatically more negative towards bicyclists, they start to validate those notions that bikes don't belong.
There is what, you know, people are calling a bike lash, a bike backlash. And the way that Bike Easy is really working through that is to bring in our coalition partners, partners from various communities that care about walking and biking from the perspective of it being something that they need and want to do. So this isn't a bike conversation. This is a people conversation.
In Long Beach, more people are becoming aware and being more receptive to bikes, but you still have the folks who think that bike infrastructure is a waste of money, a waste of time, and people don't use it. But I think in general, people are coming around and they're starting to see that, you know, this is a benefit to the city, this is a benefit to the community. It gives us options to travel and it makes our communities healthier.
The bike lash in Philadelphia, I feel like, is kind of waning at the moment. We haven't really had too much kind of crop up recently, but it's also like the city hasn't tried to do anything that took away parking recently, and that is really like the lodestar of the bike lash in Philadelphia.
In the Phoenix metro area, and so what we still have, since there's a lot of drivers there, we get that you're going to take something away from us to give to bicyclists, and it's really not, it shouldn't be looked at that way, because a lot of the bike advocates and bike planners are trying to make clear that we're trying to improve transportation for everybody, so you can still drive your car.
It's inevitable. It's an inevitable reaction to change that we need to be able to be aware of, be ready for, to manage, to predict, to address, and be responsive to the issues that people are raising.
For the most part, the tide is shifting, and I think in large part because they don't want to be seen as the New York Park Slope, you know, anti-bike people, because we talk about that a lot, like, hey, the stuff has actually already happened. If you want to do a bike lash, you got to be a little more innovative. So I even try to challenge people on their hate against bikes, and at least that gives them a little bit of a pause.
Bike lash is really a good thing in terms of change. We say there are three stages of social change: ridicule, violent opposition, and then acceptance. And sometimes there's a fourth stage too, where someone who has been opposed to it from the beginning will say, oh, you know what, I was really, that was such a great idea, I was really for it right from the start. And it makes all of us giggle and be happy, and we just go on doing good work.
So those were reflections on bike lash from the United States. We are in London talking about it here. I'm with Robert Wright of the Financial Times and Claire Rogers of the Enfield Cycling Campaign. Should we try and end positively, thinking about what we can do as people who ride bikes, as cycle campaigners, as ordinary citizens, to overcome bike lash and to get into a world where we're not constantly fighting these kinds of arguments? Let's go round with some ideas about how to do it. And I'll start off so you can have a little think. I think that children and framing things about children is a really good way to do it. I've got two children, age 3 and 1, so they're not yet riding their bikes, but they do ride on my bike, one on the front and one on the back. And whenever I cycle around my town in Abergavenny, people are just smiling at us. They're just happy to see us on the bike, and they say, have you got room for one more? And all this kind of stuff. And they're just, it just brightens up their day to see my children enjoying being on the bike. I feel like a completely different person on a bike with two children compared to when I'm out doing a longer ride or looking more like a traditional cyclist. And I feel that children are just so much harder to argue against. And if it's about childhood freedom, everybody can remember the time when they rode their bikes as a child and the freedom that came with it, and the idea that this is something that we're bringing back to a generation of children who've lost the freedom and independence that comes with the ability to cycle around safely.
I think there is now evidence to really back up what you've just said. There were two things that got me into cycle campaigning, although I'd really call myself a street campaigner rather than a cycle campaigner. And the first one was reading a report that found that the children in Europe who were the happiest were the children who could travel independently. So those countries like Finland, Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany, where a young child can get on their bike because the streets are safe to do that. And I spoke to a Dutch woman who at the age of five cycled off to the local bakery to get bread for the family. Even in her 20s, a pride was still written on her face. And so it's no surprise that a child who can travel independently by bike or on foot because the streets are safe to do so is a happy child. And that is really what drives me. I've got two girls aged 13 and 9. And to see them being independent, all the other children in London being independent, is what really drives me, so to speak. Drive is the wrong word. Enfield Cycling Campaign is actually a very small organisation, 6 active members, but what we did was to form, through the joy of Facebook, a wider group called Better Streets for Enfield. And we've really used children in our poster campaign. So we've got pictures of children, my adorable 9-year-old with her bike saying, "I want to ride my bike to school." And as you just said, no one can argue with that. We're not talking about, lycra clad men cycling to work, which is also good. We're talking about a child simply wanting to ride to school, and that's the freedom that every child should have.
One thing I would say about this, again, I'm sorry to be constantly Mr. Negative. I've got children aged 9 and 15, and I completely identify with your experience of people saying, "It's fantastic to see them on the bike, isn't that great?" And I used to take my son around in a trailer bike, you know, rides on his own. But sometimes also you get some very strange reactions from people saying you're completely responsible to be out with your child on the bike, and sometimes, you know, even punishment passes and so on that seem aimed at that. I mean, I've come across some bad driving from people who say, how can you be endangering your child like this? You're imposing your politically correct ideology on them. So that's I'm just pointing out that nearly everything to do with bikes can somehow be turned around by a sick mind. But I very much agree with the point about how one should be arguing that it's about the system as a whole. We need to be thinking carefully about making sure that the whole transport system is healthy, because we are advocating a very complicated change to the system. As I said before, we're advocating for people who by and large are currently getting about by underground and heavy rail to be getting on bikes and coming onto the streets that currently in many cases aren't carrying them. These are complicated transport policy changes, and we need to be acknowledging that and trying to campaign with the health of the whole system in mind. And I hope that's something that people think hard about. I know that plenty of people are already doing that, so I'm not saying that people aren't, but that needs to be a real focus. And that's the argument you're going to get. That's the kind of argument that's going to work with people like Val Shawcross and people like Sadiq Khan, who absolutely hold the fate of London cycling, and by extension, to some extent, because London is a flagship for the rest of the country, British cycling as a whole, in their hands.
Do you think, Robert, because you're transport correspondent of the Financial Times, you're immersed in the data and all of this, do you think that there is sufficient data to demonstrate the effect of these kinds of projects, so that we can actually step back from the irritation, the anecdotes, the personal prejudices? Obviously, people on bikes love these things. People who are stuck in the lane of car traffic don't like them. But can we look at some hard data to say, is this an efficiency gain overall? Is the data there? Does TfL, do other city governments and other municipal governments around the country and the world need to gather better data so that you can have the arguments away from the anecdotes and away from the prejudices? Is that one way of combating bike clashes, to make it a bit more fact-based, a bit more evidence-based?
There are all kinds of different approaches you can take with the data. If you look at absolute number gains in cycling, it looks fantastic. You know, it's doubled in however many years. You look at numbers of people crossing Blackfriars Bridge in the morning rush, it looks fantastic. So you can use those data. There are other data you can use that work the other way. So
is there data that doesn't exist that would help?
I recently did a data-driven piece about the safety of cycling, and I talked about the health benefits of cycling. I'm not sure about the wider data. The big problem for cycling in the UK is that the numbers are so small.
But for these cycle superhighways, it's a relatively small area. You could have counters all around the place. You could be measuring things and talking about it. Do you feel that TfL, because that was a complaint that was made by some campaigners, was that TfL weren't coming out clearly enough with statistics, like they finally did, saying 70% of rush hour traffic on Blackfriars Bridge was people on bikes. They didn't have that in the first 10 days of this big campaign by the Daily Mail. So they weren't able to refute the misleading photographs. That's my point, that if you're going to introduce a scheme that you think is going to work, you really need to very quickly monitor it and evaluate it, so that when you do get the inevitable backlash, bike lash, you can come up with some objective, undeniable facts to support, you know, what you've done.
Transport for London have introduced something called Healthy Streets, and this is run by Lucy Irvin at TfL. And the idea is to not measure just how much traffic is going through and what mode of transport, but also whether a street is healthy. And the whole idea being, does that street encourage more active travel? And they look at things like noise, stress. It's quite a subjective survey. You ask pedestrians, how do you feel right now standing on the street? Do I have to raise my voice to make myself heard because the traffic is so noisy? Whether there's greenery, whether there's shade, whether there's planting, whether there's somewhere to sit. And all of that adds up to look at what makes a healthy street. So it's not the sort of data that you're talking about, but I think that's quite important in terms of a complete street and what makes one up.
I think another important way to overcome bike lash is to share experiences from one place to another place, the sort of demonstration effect. And I love the idea of these healthy streets and streets being given a score, so that you could score the Mini Holland in Waltham Forest and then score the Walworth Road down in Southwark, and the people of the Walworth Road can say, well, why do we get 2 out of 10 and they're getting 8 out of 10? We want one of those too. That's a great way of getting people to want something, is to feel that they haven't got something that somebody else have got, and to let them know about it. And it's quite interesting how the focus on infrastructure in UK cycle campaigning came about. It was a lot to do with the internet and the fact that you could share images, films. There were blogs taking pictures of what was going on in Holland and other places, Copenhagen. So you could go on Google Street View and look in Holland and see what it was like there. And that sharing of information, not just by relying on what was being put into the traditional media, allowed people to see that there was another way, and that maybe we could have that other way where we are.
There's certainly an argument I used to make an awful lot in New York, where there was sometimes a view that the level of street deaths there was inevitable. London, for all its shortcomings, has fewer than half the number of street deaths that New York has, with a slightly larger population and with more cars. So that's a positive thing that London's already doing. Obviously, one would like to see London improve still further, but there is undoubtedly something really salutary about sharing information between different places, that's for sure.
And doing it with photographs, I think, is often a really good way. When you're trying to communicate with people who haven't got a lot of attention to read a long report or a long blog post even, just a few well-chosen photographs that show what something could be like is very potent. What else can we be doing against the bike lash?
I think it's about reframing the conversation not to be about bicycles. And as we heard on the street films, this is not a bike conversation, this is a people conversation. I mean, locally in Enfield, people will argue with me about cycle lanes. And then if you just change the question and say, well, okay, how can we get people out of their cars? How can we reduce the volume of traffic? And everyone agrees in Enfield there are too many cars on the road. And it's, you know, how can these streets be better quality for people? And that does turn the argument around.
Robert, more pearls of wisdom, more suggestions? Because you did have quite a go at cycle campaigners for being holier than thou and are not very effective in their arguments. What should they be doing?
My worry was that a lot of the arguments that people were deploying were a little bit sort of gotcha. There's particularly, you know, when people say cyclists don't pay road tax, people say, oh, road tax was abolished in whenever it was, 1937. I'm not sure where that kind of argument really gets anybody, because the basis of people's irritation is not the hypothecation of the tax. It's the fact that they feel they are paying something for a service that other people are not paying for. And I feel it's a much more powerful argument to say, actually, the tax take from motoring does not fully cover the external cost of motoring, so everybody else is subsidizing you. So you're actually, every time you get somebody on a bike, that is improving the overall financial situation, because the cycling imposes fewer external costs on people. It's quite a complicated argument. I'm not sure how well that works as an argument. But
yeah, I find that one quite difficult to do in terms of a response to someone yelling out of their white van, "Get off the road! You don't pay your road tax." Well, actually, let me brief you on my undergraduate economics. There's a thing called externalities, and if we quantify them across the economy, can you think of a nice shorthand way of doing that? Maybe listeners, if you've got a way of capturing that kind of thing, clearly. The one less car argument, people do understand. But then I suppose in London, it's actually one less tube rider or one less bus rider. So I suppose you maybe need to appeal to the people on the tubes to say, you know, all those people on bikes could be on your tube train. Support the bike lanes.
I absolutely agree with that. Cyclists are easing overcrowding on the underground. I come in every morning from Brixton. I see people coming from Clapham. The section of the Northern Line between Clapham Common and Stockwell is one of the most overcrowded in the entire underground. All those people cycling down Clapham Road are relieving overcrowding of the people who are deep down underneath in the Northern Line, and they just can't, by the nature of things, see each other.
I mean, there's just wider arguments like health. You can't get away from the health benefits of cycling. And if people are extending their lives and their health by cycling, then that's more money on the NHS for everyone else who needs it. And in Enfield, that's a really powerful argument, because we have the highest rate of childhood obesity in the country. So it's a very clear argument that if you allow children to cycle to school or to walk to school or to scoot to school, then that's going to improve their health and save the NHS money.
The thing I would love to do, and I keep thinking about it, and I don't know whether they'll hear this and perhaps act on it, is I'd love to take some of the policymakers out for a bike ride around London and let them see what is actually going on. It so happens that I did by accident end up doing almost exactly that with Boris Johnson on one occasion, because we were both coming back from an event and he was lost and he knew that I knew where I was going, and so he asked me to show him the way, so I got a chance to bend his ear. I'd love to take Sadiq Khan on a morning bike commute from Tooting into City Hall sometime and just show him what conditions are like. You know, I think that could have a really salutary effect.
Sadiq Khan is very welcome to come on the back of my tandem in Enfield while we cycle without cycle lanes to my daughter's school.
Well, I know Sadiq Khan never misses an episode of The Bike Show, so those are two invitations for you to put to your diary secretary. If you have thoughts, having heard our discussion of Bike Clash, where it's coming from, what we can do about it, drop us a line, bikeshow@resonancefm.com. It'd be great to hear Bike Clash from where you are. Well, thank you very much, Robert Wright from the Financial Times, Claire Rogers from the Enfield Cycling Campaign. It's been a fruitful discussion, and hopefully we will get to that fourth stage of... they'll all be agreeing with it all along. All those white van men and taxi drivers, they'll be saying, yeah, never seen anything better happen to London than those bike lanes.
Okay, thank you for having me. I hope I wasn't too much of a downer.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Until next time. From noisy, smelly London. Goodbye.